when apocalypse isn't hyperbole, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The town of Amatrice is in ruins after an earthquake struck central Italy last night.
It's like an apocalypse. I cannot use other words. It's somehow unbelievable.
We'll hear more from that Red Cross worker. Also, Ukraine celebrates 25 years of independence and hopes Russia is paying attention.
Ukraine's really the path not taken by Russia. It's as if the two countries were separated at birth.
Plus,
I don't know if you've ever had the chance to get close to orangutans or go and watch macaques and gibbons, but these are incredibly cute little animals.
Cute primates and why their survival depends on your car tires. That's all coming up today on The World. Good to have you with us today. And we start with an event that lasted just 2 minutes last night, but changed life drastically in central Italy. An earthquake measuring 6.2 that has left at least 120 people dead. We'll speak with a geophysicist about the factors that make some quakes deadlier than others. That's in a minute. But first, we're going to one of the small Italian mountain towns most affected by the quake, Amatrice. It's about 100 miles northeast of Rome. Tommaso Della Longa is with the Italian Red Cross, and he's in Amatrice.
Obviously, they are shocked. The shock was really incredible. I mean, you have to think about an earthquake that lasts 142 seconds, that is really long, in the middle of the night. So it's really a nightmare, even though you are alive.
Tell us what you can see right now where you are, Tommaso.
Probably more than half of the city is destroyed, building collapsed, and it's a very sad scenario.
When you say half this town of Amatrice is destroyed, what does that look like? What do you see?
It's like an apocalypse. I cannot use other words. It's somehow unbelievable.
Are these mostly old buildings in Amatrice?
Yeah, I mean, we are speaking about old buildings. Some of them could also have like 200 years, even more probably. It's the center of the city. So, yeah, this is the situation. We don't know the proper number of people.
So you're saying that not all the people and residents of Amatrice have been accounted for?
Yeah, exactly. As a Red Cross, we are not giving official numbers and we are not confirming any other number, but I mean, the concern is there. We hope that we'll find other people alive, but it's a very difficult situation.
As I said earlier, you've got friends in Amatrice. What have they been telling you about what they experienced in the middle of last night?
Actually, one of my best friends was here, and at the end, he was lucky because at the first earthquake, they literally ran away from the house, and the building collapsed right after they went out. So they are lucky, but they are really shocked. I mean, everyone was helping the others, and it was, solidarity is always a good thing to see, obviously, in a tragedy, unfortunately.
Tell me about the search and rescue operation. Is that ongoing right now?
Yeah, sure. It's still ongoing and it will continue. We are confident that we can still find someone alive, but after several hours, it's becoming much more difficult.
I saw a report that Germany is sending assistance to Italy. What are the greatest needs for the relief effort right now?
Now we are in the real beginning of the emergency. We will have much more information and much more ideas on that when we have a clear picture of numbers, and until now it's still difficult. This is the moment of the emergency. This is the moment of finding people. We can speak about it in the next couple of hours, not now.
Tommaso, we're thinking of you. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Italy was not the only country to be hit by an earthquake in the last 24 hours. Another one struck South Asia today. It was centered in Myanmar, also known as Burma. It was a bigger quake, bigger in magnitude, but it appears to have caused less damage and a lot fewer deaths. John Bellini is a geophysicist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Golden, Colorado. Why was the quake in Italy so much more deadly than the one in South Asia appears to be, John?
Well, there's a couple reasons. The one in Italy was very shallow earthquake, and it was nearly right under a small town. And in some of these smaller towns in Italy, there's a lot of older buildings that are made of stone and cement, and they just can't take the shaking. from an earthquake that's very shallow near the surface. In Myanmar, from what I've seen so far, it seems to be just a slightly less populated area with slightly more modern buildings.
Mm. So you called the quake in Italy a shallow earthquake. Tectonically speaking, explain that to us.
Right. Earthquakes can range anywhere from rupturing right out the surface to down deeper than 300 miles below the surface.
Wow, 300 miles.
That's right. Well, actually, over 300 miles deep in some areas, such as out in the Pacific, Fiji, Vanuatu, places like that, they can get pretty deep. A shallow earthquake, we consider a shallow earthquake to be something less than about 30 or 40 miles deep. This earthquake in Italy was less than 10 miles deep, roughly 5 or 6 miles beneath the surface. So that's quite a bit shallower than in some other regions. And when you have an earthquake that's this close to the surface, it can cause more damage, even at a smaller size.
What is the risk of aftershocks between a shallow earthquake and one that is deeper?
Well, in deeper earthquakes, you usually don't see a lot of aftershocks, if any at all, especially the very deepest ones. Once the fault ruptures, you don't see a lot of shaking and aftershocks continuing on afterward. However, an earthquake that ruptures near the surface, sometimes it actually breaks the surface and you see the actual rupture on the surface. But when these earthquakes settle down, the earth still wiggles and adjusts itself for days, weeks, or even months afterward. And these smaller wiggles are actually smaller earthquakes, and we call them aftershocks.
You talked about some of the damage in Italy and the old buildings. I mean, it's one of the most active earthquake zones in the world. You would think they'd be prepared.
Well, but they've also been around in Italy for, you know, more than 1,000 years, 2,000 years in some cases, some of these towns. So they have buildings that are many hundreds of years old. And even if it's a rather well-built stone and cement construction, you know, over time, the cement wears down and buildings become more susceptible to damage.
So the last time there was a big earthquake in Italy, there were lawsuits against the official Italian seismologists from victims claiming they had no warning, that the quake was predictable. Is that ever true? Can you predict earthquakes?
We cannot predict or forecast earthquakes, not scientifically. We have not been able to do that. The best that we are able to do is to give statistical analysis that say, you know, because of the rate of strain or force building up in the crust, that an earthquake of, you know, such and such size will occur in the next 10, 20, 30 years. That's about the best we can do because there are other factors that just are very hard to account for when trying to predict an earthquake. So,
John, two earthquakes on the same day, one in Italy, one in Myanmar. Is there any connection? Does a plate shift in Italy causing other plates down the line to move?
No, these are very different areas and different geographic regions. So there's different seismic processes that work, and because of the relationship, the distance between these two, these are not related in any way. You can have, when you have a large earthquake in one area, you can have small triggered earthquakes in the same general region, but not that far away.
So putting aside the pain and loss of these events, what quake will provide the most usable scientific data, Myanmar or Italy?
Well, as far as how it affects human populations, the quake in Italy will provide more information in that respect. As far as how the Earth behaves, you know, both of these earthquakes will give information into their general seismic regions that they're part of and acting on. But as far as human information, the Italy quake will provide more.
John Bellini, a geophysicist with the USGS, speaking with us from Golden, Colorado. John, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Italy was hit today by a number of aftershocks, and those have made a tough situation there even more difficult. To see exactly what happened in Italy, we made an interactive map. You can see that at PRI.org. The odds are pretty good that you're listening to us in a car right now, so let me ask you, how are your tires? You probably don't think about them too much until there's a problem, but environmentalists do. That's because companies cut down huge areas of forest land in Southeast Asia to build rubber plantations, the source of the rubber for the tires. But as the world's Jason Margolis reports, there's a business case to be made for not chopping down the forest.
Scientists estimate that a forest area the size of Indiana will be cut down to plant rubber trees over the next 8 years. Etel Higone with Waxman Strategies in Washington says that's creating biological deserts, driving some of our favorite exotic animals toward extinction.
I don't know if you've ever had the chance to get close to orangutans or go and watch macaques and gibbons, but these are incredibly cute little animals. They also mate for life.
But environmentalists aren't just tugging at our heartstrings. Burning forests in Southeast Asia for commodities like rubber, palm, and paper releases carbon stored in trees. Last year, fires in Indonesia raged out of control.
And for 26 days in a row, the fires in Indonesia released greenhouse gases that outstripped those of the U.S. economy. It was just an incredibly serious climate change catastrophe.
There are also human rights abuses. Indigenous people have been forced from their lands in Laos, Burma, and Cambodia to build new rubber plantations. And there have been problems with child labor. Now, to be clear, tire companies like Michelin, Pirelli, and Goodyear aren't burning forests directly, but they buy rubber from contractors who do. So that's the bad news. Here's the good. Michelin, the world's largest buyer of natural rubber, says that deforestation has to stop, and it's pledging to go green. It's still early on, a work in progress, but Higone says Michelin's shift in tone is huge.
I think it's a game changer. Now that Michelin has opened the door, other companies will feel some pressure to walk through and join on that path of sustainability, if only because there is growing scrutiny.
Harvard Business School professor Rebecca Henderson says other tire companies may well follow Michelin's lead.
It may be that they're worried about reputational risk, or alternatively, hoping that really committing to sustainability will give them an advantage with consumers.
That's certainly played out in other industries. California-based clothing brand Patagonia has been a leader in its commitment to the environment, and other companies have followed its example. Now, Patagonia is also turning its attention to the rubber thing.
So this is the inside of the suit here. Just looking to build the most environmentally benign suit on the market.
Jason McCaffrey directs the company's surf division.
We joke here that you can get any color as long as it's black, after old Henry Ford.
Patagonia's new wetsuits will now use only rubber from trees harvested according to principles designed by the Forest Stewardship Council.
Which is a lot of words that means it prevents any new deforestation or clear cutting from occurring.
Of course, these new suits will cost a bit more.
On average, it's only about $20 or $30 more. I think it's a bearable amount for people to pay extra for, knowing that where their suit came from doesn't contribute to deforestation, really.
Patagonia is banking on that. This year, they've more than doubled production to keep up with early demand projections. Harvard's Rebecca Henderson doesn't know if tire customers will respond similarly to Michelin's new green initiative. But she adds, switching to sustainably grown rubber probably won't hurt the company's business.
The thing that the environmentalists say, which is, you know, we can behave better and it wouldn't be that much more expensive and is sometimes cheaper, turns out, as far as I can tell, to be often true.
I tried to find out if Michelin's new tires might cost more, but the company didn't answer that question or any of my questions. It's curious that Michelin hasn't really been more vocal touting its new sustainable rubber policy. The company does have a checkered past with environmental groups that have dogged the company for contributing to deforestation. Perhaps Michelin wants the whole rubber issue, even when it's good news, to just go away. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
A quick look ahead now before we get to the break. 25 years ago this week, Russians heard Swan Lake on the radio, and they knew that meant something was up.
In 3 days, they stare down tanks in Moscow, thousands of Russians gathered around the White House, and essentially these card-line coup plotters end up being kind of dunces.
A coup attempt in Moscow and a much-loved ballet, that's just ahead here on The World. Here's what it sounded like today in the Ukrainian capital, Kiev. National anthem played, military vehicles and soldiers paraded through Kiev's Independence Square. Today marks Ukraine's 25th year of independence from the Soviet Union. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko said his country's show of force was meant to send a signal to its enemy. That enemy would be Russia. So where is Ukraine at today after a quarter century of independence? For that, we go to Brian Whitmore with Radio Free Europe. Brian writes a blog for Radio Free Europe called The Power Vertical, which focuses on Russia and its relations with its neighbors.
I think it's a show by Ukraine that their independence is irreversible. And I think 25 years after the fact, I think Ukraine's entering these celebrations with their independence appearing to be under threat. And I think this is a message that they're willing to defend their independence. If you look back on the 25 years of Ukrainian independence, I think it shows us some really, really important things that are worth defending. Ukraine, in many ways, is the path not taken by Russia. It's developed a working democracy. It has its problems, to be sure, But if you really go back to the period right after independence, Ukraine really distinguished itself from Russia almost from the get-go. Mm. Actually, I was in Ukraine and Russia in the summer and fall of 1993. Both countries are facing an almost identical political crisis at that time. In both countries, you had a nominally reformist president. In Russia, Boris Yeltsin. In Ukraine, Leonid Kravchuk. Both were facing a parliament that was anti-reformist in both cases. In Russia, the problem was solved with President Yeltsin shelling the parliament with artillery. In Ukraine, the problem was solved in a very different way. It was solved with early elections for both the president and the parliament. And in those presidential elections, the incumbent president, Leonid Kravchuk, lost. And he did something remarkable. He stepped down and let a successor, Leonid Kuchma, take power. And that was the first time that happened in a former Soviet state. And that really set the precedent, because in Ukraine since then, you've had five presidential elections. Each of them have been competitive. In three of those cases, the incumbent or the incumbent's handpicked successor lost. So in Russia, you've had not one really truly competitive presidential election, and you've not had the incumbent or the incumbent's handpicked successor lose.
So it seems there's a greater commitment to democracy in Ukraine than Russia. But I mean, today, war in eastern Ukraine bubbles along thanks to Russia. Crimea was sliced away by Russia in 2014. How much do Ukrainians believe their own independence is really irreversible?
They fear for their independence, but they're ready to fight for it. And I think most Ukrainians do believe at the end of the day that their independence is irreversible. I mean, Ukrainian civil society, and this is another great distinction from Russia, as opposed to in Russia, Ukrainian civil society has developed to the point where it's extremely strong. And it will they will not accept giving up their independence. Russia would be occupying very, very, very hostile territory.
You made the case for why Ukrainians believe their independence is irreversible, but, I mean, Russia's always there in the background. Do you think Ukraine can ever be truly independent as long as Russia's overshadowing it?
I think Ukraine's independence is going to be under threat as long as you have a regime in the Kremlin similar to the regime we have right now. You know, Vladimir Putin famously told former U.S. President George W. Bush at the NATO summit in Bucharest back in 2008 that Ukraine isn't really even a country. And I think this really does reflect the thinking of Mr. Putin and his entourage. Mm. So as long as you have a regime like this in the Kremlin, they're going to try to undermine Ukraine's independence in any way, shape, or form, up to and including using military force.
That was Brian Whitmore with Radio Free Europe. Here's another story now that involves a 25-year anniversary and Russia. It's what you might call a political pas de deux. Swan Lake by Pyotr Ilyich Tchaikovsky is one of the most popular ballets of all time. And when it pops up on Russian or earlier Soviet radio and TV, you can bet something big has just happened. Just ask Charles Maynes and Cicely Fell. Together, they recently produced a documentary for our partners at the BBC. It's called Looping Swans. Maynes says when Soviet and Russian listeners heard the ballet broadcast on state radio and TV, they knew some sort of power struggle was going on.
For the Russian leadership at that point, or the Soviet leadership, it was always this kind of ideal stalling mechanism. It had no words. There was no sort of extra meaning to impart to people. But of course, upon repetition, the more you use it, additional meaning kind of grows. And so saying nothing became saying something.
Mm. So take us back to that moment 25 years ago this week, Charles. Citizens of the Soviet Union were hearing Swan Lake again. Why?
There was a hardline coup against Mikhail Gorbachev, who was the sort of reformist leader of Soviet Russia at that point, of the Soviet Union. And it was announced not by a news bulletin or anything else like that. It was because Swan Lake suddenly appeared on all the television channels, all the radio stations.
So let's hear an excerpt from your documentary. Here is Alexei Milev, one of thousands of Soviets and Russians caught up in these events, explaining what he heard on TV in 91.
In about 15 or 20 minutes, so they started to explain what was going on.
The uses of Vice President Gennady Yanayev has taken over presidential power.
Gorbachev is seriously ill, and they have to change something. Actually, they took the power, and these people, they were not elected.
So what happens is in the next few days is thousands of Russians or Russian Soviets gather around the White House. And this is sort of the moment in Russian history where Boris Yeltsin, the first president of then subsequently independent Russia, comes on the scene. He becomes the hero of those days. And in 3 days, they stare down tanks in Moscow, thousands of Russians gathered around the White House. And essentially, these card-line coup plotters end up being kind of dunces. They were really sort of poorly prepared. They weren't prepared to shed much blood, although three people did die. And ultimately, this became kind of the great unraveling.
It was supposed to be a critical turning point. It didn't turn out as it all appeared. Let's hear one last clip from your documentary.
So everything was absolutely perfect. We won. And my hope was that I would never see Swan Lake again in my life, actually.
And of course, now it's very sort of bitter to remember this, because it was all about hopes that never realized. And in fact, you know, were probably misplaced completely. But there was a sense, you know, if you end the story there, it was a wonderful story and a wonderful moment. But you have to end it there.
So, Charles, how are the events of August 1991 seen today in Russia?
Well, they're not looked upon very favorably by most. Vladimir Putin, president of Russia, is obviously a former KGB agent. You could say he's sort of more emblematic of the coup plotters, and certainly his crowd and his circle in the Kremlin is, than those who won those days in August back in 1991. But it's interesting, you know, if you think about Swan Lake as this kind of political meme through Russian history, it is still relevant, I think.
It is.
It's not really about Swan Lake. It's more about this fragility that was at the top of the system. If you remember just last year, Marco, there was in 2015, Putin disappeared for 10 days and the whole place went berserk because there was no plan. There's no system. So in some ways, the figurative swans, they're still there.
Looping Swan Lake. Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow, he along with Cicely Fell produced a radio documentary on Swan Lake and its appearance at critical moments in Soviet and Russian politics. Charles, thanks a lot. Always good to speak with you.
Thank you, Marco.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, it's full steam ahead for the first cruise through the Northwest Passage.
You know, everyone you talk to, they really want to see a polar bear. They really want to see the wildlife. And, you know, folks said they understand that the reason that they can get up there to see the wildlife is because the region is changing in a way that in many cases threatens that wildlife.
That story's ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Turkish tanks rolled across the border into Syria today, along with more than 1,000 Turkish-backed Syrian rebels. U.S. warplanes provided support from the air. This was Turkey's first major U.S.-backed incursion into Syria, and it took place on the same day that Vice President Joe Biden was in Turkey, meeting with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. By day's end, the Turkish military operation had succeeded in clearing militants from the Syrian town of Jarablus, one of ISIS's last strongholds along the Syrian-Turkish border. The operation has another stated target, Syrian Kurdish fighters, but the U.S. has been relying on them to dismantle ISIS from Syria. The BBC's Rich Hall has been covering the story. He's in Beirut. So the Turkish military apparently arrived in Jarablus, this town in Syria that had been the goal. What does this mean in the overall fight against ISIS?
So what this means is that part of the reason, as you said, that Turkey launched this operation was to block the progress of Syrian Kurds. Now, one of the reasons behind this is that Syria's Kurds have been making steady progress against ISIS in Syria, and they've been capturing towns along Turkey's border for some months now. Now, Turkey has a problem with Kurds in its own country. It's fighting quite a brutal urban conflict with a Kurdish rebel group in Turkey, and that Kurdish rebel group happens to be linked to the Kurds in Syria. So it views the Kurds in Syria as the same organization as the Kurds it's fighting at home, and it views them with suspicion. That's why it's moved to block them and their progress in Syria.
Right, and the Syrian Kurds, as I said, they were fighting for the U.S. against ISIS. I mean, that's got to be problematic for the U.S., isn't it?
That's right. They're one of the key allies in the fight against ISIS. They're a recipient of U.S. assistance. So you have U.S. military advisors working on the ground alongside the Syrian Kurds, the YPG, which is what they're called. It's a very difficult position for the U.S. to be in because they're also working to fight ISIS with Turkey, a NATO ally.
Right. I mean, we've been hearing, Rich, that the White House has actually been encouraging this action today by Turkey, Operation Euphrates Shield, as it's called. Vice President Biden was in Ankara today in meetings with Turkish President Erdogan. Do we know whether they agreed to anything on targeting Syrian Kurds?
There seems to be some sort of tacit agreement which pleases and displeases both sides. So U.S. has agreed to support Turkey's operation into Syria. And at the same time, the U.S. has asked or demanded that the Syrian Kurds withdraw east of the Euphrates River, which is one of the demands Turkey has been making for quite a while now. So the U.S. is simultaneously trying to allay Turkish fears of Kurdish gains in Syria and also not betray its Kurdish allies who have done such a good job fighting the Islamic State.
If you look at what's going on in Turkey between these meetings with Vice President Biden and President Erdogan, I mean, Biden seems to be bending over backwards to please Turkey. What is at stake with the U.S.-Turkish relationship right now?
For the U.S., Turkey is such an important ally in fighting the Islamic State. So relations between the U.S. and Turkey have not been great over the past few months. Turkey has been angry at the U.S. reaction to the attempted coup that took place last month. It said that the U.S. didn't react quickly enough, it didn't give enough sympathy. So as well as trying to fix this delicate situation in Syria, Biden has also been making overtures to President Erdogan and Turkish government. He actually apologized to the president today for not coming to Turkey sooner. So at the same time as trying to solve this seemingly intractable problem between its two allies, it's also been trying to repair relations that were damaged in the aftermath of this coup, attempted coup.
Right. And today, Biden also was praising President Erdogan for his strength after that attempted coup last month. So now that the Turkish military incursion Operation Euphrates Shield has taken this northern Syrian town of Jarablus, what next? Will the Turkish army head back to Turkey or will they march on deeper into Syria?
It's difficult to say. From my point of view, I think one of the main reasons they went into Syria was to block the advance of the Syrian Kurds in taking that whole stretch of the Syria-Turkey border. So I think by being in Jarablus, they can achieve that aim. The dangers arise in that the Syrian Kurds and Turkey are now facing off against each other. They have this sort of soft front line between each other now in Syria, and that has the potential to flare up. And if it does, then who knows what Turkey might do. They might decide they want to capture more of its own border with Syria to take it away from the Kurds.
All right, Rich, we're going to leave it there. The World's Rich Hall speaking with us from Beirut. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
In Turkey, traditions die hard. Just peek into Istanbul's Old City. That's where you can still find coppersmiths, carpet sellers, and vendors measuring out dried fruit and nuts with metal weights. And for as long as anyone can remember, those doing the selling have been men, still are. But Christina Asquith of our Women's Lives Project visited a family-owned candy shop where times are changing.
Men pull wooden carts down cobblestone streets, heading to the covered markets of the Grand Bazaar, just as they have for 500 years. Hakan Altan stands by the open door of the candy shop his great-great-grandfather started a century and a half ago. He's worked here since he was five. Candy making is a Turkish art, Hakan tells me. Our candy's history goes back to the Janissaries, the army of the Ottoman Empire. When they got their salary, if it was sufficient, they would send candies to the Sultan. Inside the shop, Hakan scoops candy for a customer. Traditional sweets are stacked from floor to ceiling. Turkish delights dusted in powdered sugar. Hard candies flavored with rose water, orange, and pistachio. And helva, crushed sesame seeds and honey. On the walls, there are yellowing photos of Hakan's ancestors. There's nothing modern here. Well, there is one thing.
My name is Arzu. I'm 27 years old. I'm a mathematics engineer and I'm working in a software company for the business development and the marketing manager.
This is Arzu, Hakan's daughter, his only child. If the business is going to stay in the family, she's going to have to take it over. And a woman taking over a business just doesn't happen here in the Old City. It's still a man's world.
People are thinking that women have less information than the man. These kinds of people are the old people who you are talking with. He thinking, okay, where is your father? Come on, I will ask them.
You can barely find a woman running a business in the old quarters. And across Turkey, most women still don't have bank accounts. This is slowly changing as more young Turkish women are breaking with tradition, entering university, starting careers and earning salaries of their own. But that's not happening here in the old city yet, where a woman like Arzu still looks out of place with her neon sneakers and iPhone, walking past the coppersmiths and traditional dusty carpet shops. She knows it's going to be a big challenge winning over customers' trust when she takes over the candy shop.
Sometimes the people are not giving trust to you sometimes for a woman. That if you are a woman, people are thinking that, okay, she didn't know anything. She can't say the true thing, or she can't help to me that.
I get a hit of what a man's world it is when Hakan takes me above the shop to see the candy making. It's hot, and the men are wiping sweat from their brows as they operate big metal machines that shape and cut the candy. Hakan tells me they are boiling the sugar in cauldrons before setting it in molds. The candy shop has seen so much history. The Ottoman Empire, two world wars, and five military coups, including the failed one last month. The family knows it needs to adapt to changing times. The pressures of globalization, cheap candy flooding in from elsewhere, and lately, tourists scared away by terrorist attacks. This is where Arzu comes in. The family hopes her education and sophistication will keep the business alive. And she actually thinks being a woman will be an advantage.
Women are seeing the whole picture. Women knows understanding the customer's need. They are thinking more delicately than the man. Sensitive, more sensitive than the others.
More sensitive and perhaps more outward. She thinks there's an untapped market for selling the candy overseas, and she's developing a marketing plan to take advantage of that. As we're talking, Arzu's 93-year-old grandfather totters in.
Merhaba. He is our big boss, I think.
It strikes me that he has spent his whole life between the shop and the street. He's clearly proud that his granddaughter is educated and living in a larger world. And as for passing the shop on to a woman?
Olur, niçin olmasın?
Of course, he tells me as Arzu listens on. Why not? For the world, Christina Asquith, Istanbul.
Here's an eye-opening story about how melting ice is changing the Arctic. This week, the first large commercial cruise ship starts sailing through the Northwest Passage. That is a sea route from Alaska, over the top of Canada, and through to New York. Until recently, it's been impassable because of ice. But recent melting has opened it up to shipping, and now two large cruise ships, like the 1,600-person, 13-deck Crystal Serenity. Reporter Rachel Waldholtz has been covering the cruise for Alaska Public Radio. So you were on the ship before it left from Seward, Alaska last week. What was the buzz there? What were passengers looking forward to?
Passengers were really excited. I think the funny thing about this cruise is that most of the folks who are on it are repeat cruisers. So one of the passengers I talked to, this is her 16th cruise on the Crystal Serenity. So for a lot of them, when they're getting on the ship, it's sort of like coming home. And so they're getting on the ship. They're really excited. They're really excited to be the first to go through the Northwest Passage. And the ship itself is really quite something. You walk in and there's piano music playing and it feels like a very high-end hotel.
Wow, pretty luxurious, it sounds like.
Yeah, definitely luxurious. I think casino, spa, theater, pool. So when folks aren't looking at wildlife, there's lots to do on the ship.
What about people who live in Alaska? What do they think of this historic voyage?
It certainly got a lot of press here. It was stopping at three places in Alaska. So it left from Seward, and then it stopped in Kodiak on Alaska, and then Nome. And Nome, you know, is about 4,000 people. So a cruise ship with 1,600 people on board is a big influx. So there was a ton of preparation that went into it just to make sure that there's, you know, enough for folks to do and so that the towns can take economic advantage of this.
Yeah, and it sounds like the ship will also be stopping in smaller towns and villages.
Yeah, some of the towns it's stopping in Canada are smaller than the ship itself, so, you know,
wow.
1,500 people or less.
So because of the melting ice, this cruise ship does not need ice-breaking capabilities. But what if there's some kind of really unmelted iceberg that it hits? I mean, is anybody worried of some kind of Titanic replay?
Yeah, there definitely is a lot of concern. And so, you know, the Coast Guard up here has been preparing for this since 2012. And actually, just as the Crystal Serenity is passing through the Bering Strait this week, there is a big Coast Guard and military exercise simulating exactly that, sort of what would happen if a cruise ship went down. The simulation assumes 250 passengers, and it involves the Coast Guard, the military, the Royal Canadian Air Force. There's going to be 1,000 people sort of going through this search and rescue simulation because we just haven't had to deal with this before. You know, there just hasn't been this kind of passenger ship passing through the Arctic. And so we haven't had to have these kind of resources ready in case something goes wrong. So I think there is a lot of concern, and there's also been a ton of preparation.
Yeah. What about environmental regulations? Because this is a ship that is going through a relatively untouched area for the first time.
Yeah, you know, I spoke to environmentalists who are concerned about things like sewage and wastewater discharge and, you know, what if there's an oil spill? And folks said that Crystal Cruises, that runs the Crystal Serenity, has actually done a really good job here. So they plan to exceed environmental standards for wastewater discharge. They have a logistics ship that's traveling with them that will take extra trash so that they're not leaving it along the trip. They're going to be using sort of a different grade of oil that would be easier to clean up in the event of a spill. People say they've really prepared for this trip. But the concern is sort of what happens next, because all of these measures are voluntary and people are really seeing the Crystal Serenity as maybe a sign of what's coming. And if this cruise is successful, it could lead to a lot more tourism in the Arctic. And will other companies follow suit and follow sort of the same high standards?
Well, there is an element of bad news to this cruise. It's only possible because climate change is melting ice in the Northwest Passage. Are passengers or Crystal Cruises acknowledging that at all?
Yeah, you know, one of the passengers that I talked to said, you know, you feel a little bit guilty because the whole reason that you can get up there is because the region is transforming so quickly. And, you know, everyone you talk to, they really want to see a polar bear. They really want to see the wildlife. And, you know, folks said they understand that the reason that they can get up there to see the wildlife is because the region is changing in a way that in many cases threatens that wildlife.
You know, I just found out, Rachel, that cruise ships have a carbon footprint that is almost twice as bad as flying. Do they know that they're also contributing to the problem that is allowing them to take these Arctic cruises?
Yeah, you know, I didn't talk to passengers about that specifically. People did seem very aware of sort of the symbolism of their cruise. You know, why is it possible? It's possible because of climate change. And it's interesting because there are sort of all of these environmental fears about a cruise ship moving through there and about shipping moving through there. But I think there's also a lot of optimism in Alaska that tourism could really bring some positive upsides, that the more people that can access the region and that can see the region become then invested in taking care of the region. And so there's some hope that, you know, if this is done in a responsible way, that it could really be a boon for the Arctic.
Reporter Rachel Waldholtz with Alaska Public Media speaking with us from Anchorage. Rachel, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, a little detour now to tell you about a story we'll have for you tomorrow. It's about a very important debate playing out around the world, a debate over bodily functions. Here's the question. Is it better to use a Western-style commode toilet or the squat toilet more common in the developing world? Well, this gastroenterologist in Thailand says the squat technique wins out.
The squat method is good for poo more than sit on the chair.
But not everyone agrees. The great toilet debate, that's tomorrow on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Vacation was good, partly because I did not log on once to Facebook. It felt great. Good thing I did not know about one Facebook page from Argentina. I might not have had that moratorium. On this page, people post phrases they hear other people say in the street. I know that's not unique, but let's say Argentines are the oversharers of the Spanish-speaking world. And so their postings are sometimes funny, really funny, sometimes moving, and sometimes downright profane. The World's Maria Muriel has been checking it out. Maria, maybe the best comparison for this Argentine Facebook page is Humans of New York, that great blog. But you think the street quotes from Argentina are actually better. So
they're so much better. I mean, I love Humans of New York, but this page, it's called La Gente Anda Diciendo, People Are Saying. And I was mesmerized by just like, especially the kids' postings, like the things that kids say.
Like what?
Okay, so there was one. Oh, there's one where this little like 5-year-old or something like that is telling his mom, you know, mom, I have to tell you something and it's going to hurt. It's going to be difficult. But I had somebody else's stew and it was better. But don't worry, I still love you. And, you know, just like to imagine this little 5-year-old Argentine kid so eloquently telling his mom that he had better food than the one she cooks. But
right.
It's okay, mom. Don't worry. I still love you. That's just such a great sort of look into the culture.
It reminds me a little of Metropolitan Diary, which I'm not sure if it's in the New York Times anymore. Just overheard stuff in the street. Give me another example from this Facebook page.
There's some that are more reflective. And I spoke to the founder of this page. His name is Ezequiel Mandelblom. He mentioned that one of the reasons the phrases are so good in Buenos Aires is because people in Buenos Aires go to therapy. They have therapists, so they'll be talking about, you know, analyzing their partners and stuff like that. And sometimes there was one, let me find it for you. So it's a 17-year-old girl, and she's saying to a friend, it's like, we're sitting here, and everything is around us, and I don't know where to go. But they're like sitting at a park, and it's just like this very meandering thought of I don't know.
Well, it's dipping into people's lives and conversations that you wouldn't normally have access to.
Yeah. And one of the other things that Ezekiel tries to capture with these phrases is he tries to pick the ones that spark a story in your imagination. Mm. So something that you're going to read that's going to make you imagine what that person must have been talking about or what they must have been going through. There was one of a man who's running down the street and he's on the phone and he's telling the person on the phone, "You're going to get an email. Be careful, but don't worry, I'll explain later." And just that, wow. Out of context, somebody running probably with a suitcase.
I want to know the rest of the story now.
Yeah, like I want to follow that guy and see what he's talking about.
So why did Ezekiel start this page?
So he and his friend Tatiana were sitting at a cafe in Buenos Aires about, let's see, it was in 2011. And they were sort of overhearing phrases out of context from the table next to them. And they couldn't exactly tell what the people were talking about, but some of the things were funny, just like out of context like that. You know, when you sometimes like snoop into other people's conversations. So they thought, you know, this would be a good thing to collect and make into a book. So they collected phrases for about 9 months, and then they decided to start posting them on Facebook. And all of a sudden, the page blew up. And it's so popular. Now, they've actually traveled through South America with a sponsorship from Motorola. So it is similar to Humans of New York in that way, that they've traveled, you know, and now there's imitation pages. But I personally think that the one from Buenos Aires is still the best one. I just think some of the observations are just really on point.
Yeah, pretty cool, though, that it spread. Some of these quotes are funny, but it seems like there is also something to learn from this. I don't want to get too intellectual about it, but when you read some of the phrases, what kind of vibe do you get?
I'll leave you with this one that I read today. It was a mom telling her 9-year-old kid, and it's really funny the way they write it, too. The quote is, "Do you see, you can do this. You're going to be able to do anything in this life." And the attribution is mom of about 30 wiping the boogers from her 9-year-old son. It's fantastic.
Everything is possible as long as you got a mom around with a Kleenex.
True.
The world's Maria Muriel. Thanks very much for telling us about this Facebook page.
Thank you, Marco.
And if you want to read some more of those gems from Argentina, you're in luck. We've got a selection of them at PRI.org. So the Olympics may be over, but it being Brazil, the music is still wafting through the air. And it being Brazil, the music really never stopped. That's definitely the case for a musician and DJ named Boima Tucker. Tucker was born in Milwaukee, but now lives in Rio. Last Friday on the show, he took us out with a recent fave of his, new music from Brazil. And when it comes to Brazilian music, we're always game for more on the world. Here's Boima Tucker again, back to tell us about two more tracks, including this one.
This is Coletivo del Tambor with Carimbó.
This is a song that I came across after moving to Brazil, and I was just really drawn to it because to me it embodies a lot of different kind of transnational connections between the Caribbean and West Africa, Central Africa, and Europe. And it was a surprise to me to hear this kind of style in Brazil. Vai juntando o cotovelo, desce a mão lá no joelho, pega lá no tornozelo, vem dançar o carimbó. Vai juntando o cotovelo, desce a mão lá no joelho, pega lá no tornozelo, vem dançar o carimbó.
A Brazilian musician once told me his country's artists are like satellite dishes, capturing sounds and influences from around the globe. That's why music in Brazil is always rich. Take samba. Today's samba is definitely no longer your traditional samba. Check out this tune, Duas Cidades, by Baiana System. Todo dia acorda cedo pro trabalho, bota seu gordão de alho e segue firme pra batalha. Olho por olho, dente por dente, espalha, lei da Babilônia é diferente.
For me, really, really what gets me first is just like, it's just so well produced. They're using something called a guitarra baiana. It's like that little guitar sound, it's a mini guitar. The way that just, the melody is on that with the delivery by the lead singer, Huso Passa Puso, is just really, I don't know, it just kind of gets to me. And it's like kind of like in a samba style, but samba from Bahia, which has a different kind of swing than Rio. This song just came out, and you know, I just really, really dig it. Cidade alta, cidade baixa, diz, e que cidade que você...
Rio-based DJ and musician Boima Tucker selected the tracks for us today. He spoke with the world's Will Carlos about what he's been digging in Brazil. If you want more, Will has dug in even deeper. You can read his post and discover some great music videos at PRI.org. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you all tomorrow. Olho por olho, dente por dente, espalha. Lei da Babilônia é diferente. Quem vigia compra trevo escapulário, bota seu cordão de alho e segue firme pra batalha. Olho por olho, dente por dente, espalha. Lei da Babilônia é diferente. Já na descida não sabe descer dançando. Sabe subir na vida, não sabe subir sambando. Chega a saudade, saudade sai bagunçando. E quando sai da cidade, show falar Salvador. Já na descida não sabe descer dançando.
PRI, Public Radio International.